Food as the language of the heart. The act of cooking with love is a spiritual practice for me. This spiritual practice supports my well-being. It allows me to be my authentic, loving self. Now, before you start envisioning me as some sort of Julia-like personality, working in the kitchen in a euphoric state, chopping, mixing, simmering, that's not my reality. As much as I wish that was the case, cooking is often a tedious, monotonous chore to be finished. I am not speaking of the day-to-day, that thought that creeps up upon me when I'm leaving work. What am I going to make for dinner today? Rather, I am speaking of the intentional act of cooking with love, of preparing a meal with my hands and heart in the spirit that it may provide someone with nourishment for both their body and their soul. Many of my childhood memories involve my mother cooking in the kitchen. The smells of chiles roasting, tortillas cooking on an open flame, my mother preparing dinner for my sister, my father, and me. Oftentimes, these meals were only for the three of us. My father was a migrant farm worker, and he would be gone for months on end. My mother's food has always been a comfort to me. Since having a family of my own, it has become a comfort I yearn for and do not experience nearly as often as I wish I could. I grew up in poverty, a poverty that I did not realize until I left for college and saw how others lived. The community that I grew up in was poor and a farming community. Most of my friends also lived in this poverty, but I never felt that I lacked anything as a child. My parents made sure that my sister and I had food, laughter, and joy. I remember being in the back of my Catholic church. My sister and I played with friends while my mom waited in line to receive cheese, flour, sugar, and bread provided to people in the community who were in need. This is a happy memory for me, a situation that happened often. After we received the food, we would walk a couple of miles back to our home where my mother would open the packages and divide them up for neighbors who were not as fortunate as we were. My mother taught me how food is the language of love. This is not something she ever spoke of. It was something that I observed by the way that she lived. Growing up, I remember men approaching the fence of our home, asking if my mom had work that needed to be done around the house in exchange for a little money. This was very common in my hometown, as many men were away as migrant workers. My mom always kindly said no, and she always offered to make them something to eat. As the winter time approaches, I reminisce about how I spent my holidays as a child. My mother, sister, and I would tie our hair back in pañuelos or handkerchiefs and spend the entire day kneading masa, cooking meat, tying the corn husk, and cooking the tamales. We would make well over 100 tamales, freezing some so that we could enjoy them throughout the year with friends and family. My mother and sister still make tamales every year, and she gives some to me when I go visit her for Christmas, and I ration them out to share with friends and family. A few months ago, I received many meals that were delivered to my house by friends, many of whom sit here today. I had surgery on my right arm and was unable to cook or do much else for my family for a few weeks. I felt appreciative of the kindness and generosity so many showed toward me and my family. The food that was provided not only nourished us, but provided me with peace of mind that my family was cared for, even when I couldn't do much for them. It allowed me to rest, something that I often struggle with, and it allowed me to heal. The lessons my mother taught me are ingrained in me. The love of helping others has become a career for me and touches all aspects of my life. The desire to reach out to those that are in need through cooking is a healing process for me. Intentionally cooking with love becomes a meditation or a prayer or a desire to help someone who is going through a difficult time. At times when I do not have the words to express myself when faced with somebody's suffering, I cook for them with love.
So the reading, to sort of branch from our somewhat similar talks, is by Cesar Chavez, and he said, if you really want to make a friend, go to someone's house and eat with him. People who eat with you and give you their food will give you their heart. And of course, we all know many sayings about food, sayings in quotes, that's food for thought. One of my favorites, life is uncertain, eat dessert first. It's true. Or the more philosophical sayings like food is symbolic of love when words are inadequate, which is what Lou was just discussing, or cooking is like love, it should be entered into with abandon or not at all, by Harriet Van Horn. However, I think it's fair to say that throughout history, the preparation of food has not been valued as highly as its consumption. There's a story in the Bible's New Testament which is told over and over by Christians in sermons and books and classrooms. And it goes somewhat as paraphrased as follows. Jesus and his disciples visit the house of a friend, Lazarus. As was typical in that time of place and is not so untypical of this time and place, the men sat and discussed religious and doctrinal points while the woman worked very hard to prepare a meal for the men. One of the sisters, whose name was Mary, snuck into the main area and she sat and listened to the men. She was enchanted with this discussion of religious fine points. Her older sister, Martha, was running around like a crazy woman in the kitchen, trying to get the meal organized and prepared. And she finally complained to Jesus, "Can't you get her to come back to work?" And Jesus said, "Well, don't worry about such things. She has the better path. She is participating in the discussion of religion, which will benefit her soul." Well, I have to tell you, I've heard that story literally hundreds of times in my childhood. And I would sit there and listen to it in school or in church, and something always felt wrong to me. During that process, I reached the decision that the entire central thesis of this story, this moral, was wrong. As an added side benefit, however, that led to me eventually joining the UU Church, it came to me that if your life experiences show you a different truth from what religious leaders and even Jesus Christ say, go with your gut. And to me, Martha had the better place. She was the one actually caring for the lives and hunger of those that she loved. She was helping them keep their lives happy in the here and now that we actually know exists, not some potential future place that may or may not happen. As an added benefit, however, to me, there are some religious teachers who support my point of view, and they tend to be Eastern religious leaders. Zen Master Edward S.B. Brown has said, when you're cooking, you're not just cooking, you're not just working on food. You're working on yourself. You're working on other people. So personally, and similarly to what Lou said, I think of food preparation and caring for the other people as a way to see goodness or God. By way of a background, my mother is not a good cook, has never been a good cook. She is a horrible cook. When my father and I were recently reminiscing about my childhood, he came out for my birthday in August, and we were talking about my childhood, which is now, well, more than 45 years ago, and we still have a strong memory of the gag reflex we had each night at dinner. We endlessly got the pleasure of experiencing yet another undercooked, yet somehow burnt and completely tasteless dinner. Quite often it was some beans and rice, and to be fair, I don't know if it was her lack of training, an extreme dislike of any kind of seasoning, even salt, which continues to this day, or the fact that all the food that we had as well was donated. I know those commodities lines myself. But it is what it is. That food was wretched. In the period between 1969 and 1971, my Northern California, very missionary-minded, young, idealistic parents moved to rural Mississippi, where my father could sell books to convert people to their religion. He was paid a percentage of the sale price of these religious books. This is not a lucrative business. selling doctrinal and denominationally based books in a part of the country where the Great Depression was barely noticed for its coming or going. There was very little change. Life was deplorably poor at all times there. And my mother was extremely overwhelmed and depressed with three small children and no social network with which she felt comfortable at all. So occasionally my father would relieve her stress by taking me, the oldest child, on some of his long trips through the hills of central Mississippi. We stopped by many, many homes at all times of day, quite often sleeping in the car after an evening call had ended. I was a scrawny, ugly child. I really was. I was skeletally thin because I refused to eat all but the bare minimum amount of food my mother could shove in me. I was dressed in homemade dresses that were made from cotton flour sacks. They really did sell flour in cotton bags, and I had dresses out of those. And I was covered with hair that has never, ever conformed to a brush or comb, even now with the best of intention and gel. It just doesn't. It never did. And I was pretty miserable because my parents were not big on positive reinforcement. One of my father's favorite phrases was that the child is praised, the child can become vain and ignorant. And they didn't converse with each other except for sniping, in my mother's case, or yelling, in my father's case. So you could say my spirit was as hungry as my little body. As my father and I drove along, we would eventually reach some rural home where the people were even more poor than we were. But the reception was always the same. We were graciously accepted inside. My father got to talking to the men of the house, like Mary and Martha's story, or if they weren't at home, the mother. And I was hugged and kissed and led to the kitchen to be fed. To be hugged and kissed and told what a sweet little thing you are is really just a salve to the soul. And I will, you know, granted these women were all experienced with five-year-olds and realistically knew that the best way to keep one from causing a ruckus is to feed her, but I still don't think of that in that pragmatic way. So then, and in my memories ever since, I'm sitting in a pool of warmth, a woman of some middle age, dripping in sweat, in the hot, humid kitchen. There was no such thing as residential air conditioning in Mississippi in the late 60s and early 70s, believe me. So we're dripping in sweat. I'm being served some enormously tasty meal, always ending in a pie. So if you wonder why I don't like cake, that's why. I'm a pie person. And it was truly heaven on earth. Quite often I was served a plate of spicy corn, tomatoes, pepper, and okra, or perhaps some kinds of green that were, unbeknownst to my vegetarian father, seasoned as all southern vegetables are with pork. It was the most amazing thing you could possibly imagine, and I still love those foods. Southern food is my comfort food. All of this while being told repeatedly what a good, sweet, beautiful little girl I was, and no one else told me these things. The whole memory is one that I continue to treasure and have always treasured in dark and depressing times, this whole feeling of warmth. The room is warm, the food is warm, it's spicy, and I'm feeling loved, and this is all mixed together. And it has the feeling of the Mary and Martha story to me. The men are talking about religion in the background, and I'm eating in the kitchen with the women. So to me, this is an image of God in my mind and heart, the serving warmth and food. As one of the most obvious ways that I saw love given, providing good food became something I've cultivated in myself for family and friends after leaving home. The warm feeling of baking a pie for someone, seeing the joy on that person's face, and knowing you filled their stomach as well as their soul is a deeply satisfying emotion. And as Lou and I have both suggested, there are many people who see this experience of cooking for and feeding others as a spiritual practice. A spiritual practice, I think, probably all know, but I did look up in Wikipedia, the source of all knowledge. And spiritual practice is the performance of actions and activities undertaken for the purpose of inducing spiritual experiences and cultivating spiritual development. Common metaphor used by many religious traditions is of walking a path. Other common spiritual practices, of course, include prayer and meditation, fasting, not my favorite, or acts mindfully engaged in, such as flower arranging, Japanese tea ceremony, gardening. By mindfully engaging in a spiritual practice, a person can gain inner strength and peace. Spiritual practices are used by people in every religion and by many people with no particular religious beliefs as a way to focus the mind and heal the spirit. According to Dr. Christina Hibbert, who talks about self-care and healing, spiritual practices help us in many ways. They can help to calm and heal the spirit, and this can help to heal the mind and body. They also help increase our personal growth and strengthen our relationships with others. Because when we get quiet and still, we listen and hear what we need to know to improve ourselves and our relationships. Spiritual practices can improve our health by practicing meditation, mindfulness, prayer, walking in the woods. All of these things have been shown scientifically to improve our feelings of wellness. They can help to heal us from psychic or spiritual wounds. When we focus on creating a mindful sense and improving our spiritual health, we feel emotionally stronger and can heal. When we engage in spiritual practices and listen to these whispers inside ourselves, we grow healthier physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, and spiritually. We grow. So when we get still, meditate, connect, and listen, we uncover our joy, leading to a source that can improve our lives and those around us. Eckhart Tolle said something very similar. It is from inner space, the unconditioned consciousness itself, that true happiness, the joy of being, emanates. To beware of little quiet things, you have to be quiet inside. A high degree of alertness is required. Be still. Look. Listen. Be present. Some years ago, there was a sermon here at Star King regarding spiritual practices. This particular speaker said that she engaged in the mindful practice of folding laundry and ironing. Now, to me, folding laundry is not relaxing, and I avoid ironing at all costs. We don't even know what the iron looks like. But to her, the peace that she felt in this activity of taking warm laundry out of the dryer, folding it, ironing clothes, and left her mind free to wander into meditation or peaceful emptiness. And she was doing this all while she felt that she was providing for her family, and it was a very life-affirming experience for her. I find that with baking or cooking food. Many people find that baking or cooking for others is a spiritual practice. Laura Cavanna, who has a book called The Spiritual Practice of Cooking, says there are several reasons for this. Cooks are patient. You can't rush through the cooking process or it'll be ruined. Cooks are creative. They look at incompatible ingredients and see delicious possibilities. They're diligent. They do it over and over and over and over and over and over again. Day after day, meal after meal. This just requires dedication. Cooks are intuitive. They test out new recipes, experiment with new ingredients, and use measurements like dash and pinch. And cooks are caring. They provide daily sustenance for those they love the most, for the hungry around them. They bring cookies and cupcakes to school bake sales, serve in soup kitchens, share casseroles, pot roasts, pies, cookies at church for, you know, coffee hour or potlucks. What is it about providing food for others that is so life-affirming to so many people? Well, obviously, food is a basic requirement for life. Even more than the actual energy and the nutrients that food provides, there's a well-established and researched theory which was developed by the psychologist Abraham Maslow in 1943 that says that humans have a variety of needs. And as he originally presented it, it was a pyramid, and there were about five levels of needs. And the first levels had to be met before you could get into a higher level. And they started at food and water and shelter, safety, love and belonging, esteem and self-actualization, and kind of at the top of the pyramid, if you can visualize it. And a need motivates a person until it's met. And this push to motivate the need gets stronger the longer and longer it is not filled. You have to satisfy this lower level need before you can move up toward growth and self-actualization. His theory was that in order to improve the human condition all over the world, to decrease bigotry and improve personal opportunity, to develop better governments and more socially responsive businesses, we must ensure that people have sufficient food, clean water, and shelter, and a basic sense of safety about their families before we can move on to any other level. The idea that it is important for a person's basic needs to really emphasize food and shelter has become more important in the social aspect of religions through the years. And it was, in fact, one of the basic tenets of liberation theology, which was developed by the Catholic, or some members of the Catholic Church, I wouldn't say the Catholic Church as a whole, in Latin America in the 1950s and 60s as a reaction to poverty and social injustice. Many other leaders, of course, we can talk about, have emphasized that we need to feed the masses literally as well as in other ways. The fact that feeding a person's physical body is important to maintaining and improving society is unchallengeable. It is also my belief, however, that the actual act, the process of feeding someone else, is important for psychological and spiritual growth for the giver as well as the recipient. When I was a young woman, Mother Teresa became an emblem of this philosophy to me. She was certainly not perfect. I don't agree with many of her viewpoints or many things that she did, but some of the things really stuck with me. For instance, such statement as, if you can't feed 100 people, feed just one. Seems to me it'd be a perfect description of these life-affirming experiences I have had, particularly those I mentioned earlier when I was a child. Those poor women in central Mississippi, in feeding on smiling on just one child, made lifelong impressions that changed me in my life permanently and for the better. From these women, I learned that it's important to feed those around me. During school and growth into adulthood, the teachings of psychologists such as Abraham Maslow, political leaders like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., and religious leaders such as the writings of the liberation theologists that I mentioned and Mother Teresa only enhance this strong ethic. So if you have accepted that preparing food could be a spiritual practice for you and one you wish to participate in, well, how do you develop that as a spiritual practice? First thing is you really have to appreciate food. It can't be an effective spiritual practice for you if it doesn't provide individual meaning, such as the laundry experience from someone who talked to me. And it helps if you can rely on important and positive early memories of food and situations to motivate you. Also, it's really good and useful to know how to prepare something, because if you don't know how to do it, food preparation is very stressful. So for me, with my background in the non-preparation of food, it required a lot of time getting to know recipes and practicing regularly, often on my poor, unsuspecting husband. In addition to getting comfortable through practice, I found it helps to have really good, sufficient time for peaceful cooking or baking and to be able to have some good ingredients. So cooking at the end of a long work day and commute is not a spiritual practice. But on the other hand, for me, baking a pie on a restful weekend for my family and friends can be one of the best experiences I've had all week. Once you have the ability to cook something and the ingredients to make it, then you can add the spiritual practice element. And for me, how I did that, particularly at the beginning, was to put on some peaceful music and attempt to slowly move my mind into a state of calm awareness. This is very similar to what is often done in any kind of meditation. And if thoughts came into my mind, I soothed them away with memories of what I had served others before or what I thought that this particular meal would be like. And it became easier and easier to mold my mind into that state of mindful awareness and simply to become one with the process, which has a negative side effect that if I'm doing that and you come in and start talking to me, it'd be very jolty. But I have worked through my life to continue to find ways and places where the provision of food to others can be an enhancement of spiritual practice. This entire process for me follows a certain flow and the presentation in a certain manner to follow that spiritual practice. If you don't want to use cooking as your spiritual practice, you can find many other ways to engage in giving spiritual food to yourself and to others, enhancing your feelings of calmness and understanding with the world. Food provides meaning in so many ways. Whether you find food to be a spiritual experience because it meets basic needs, allowing you to then focus on love and self-actualization, or you use food as an expression of emotion that you just can't verbalize, or if you join me in seeing the making and giving of food as a spiritual practice, let's all rejoice that it's there. Without food, where would we be? Without coffee hour, where would our church be? Who can feel truly and accepted and welcomed without the gift of a drink and a bit of food? Thank you.